This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Larry. This is Tim Harford speaking. How are you doing?
Hello, Tim. Nice to talk to you. And I think again, isn't it?
It is again. We met in a hotel room in Oxford in about 2012, Skull World Forum. Well remembered. You know, the thing that really sticks with me about that meeting is that I walked in with a TED bag slung over my shoulder.
Yes, yes.
And you were like a sommelier. Like, oh, that, I think that's a TED Global 2011 bag. You could sort of call the vintage.
From Scotland it was, actually. Yes, I know.
Larry, we're off to a flying start, so shall we just get straight into it? Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of How to Vaccinate the World. I'm Tim Harford. Now, there aren't many epidemiologists who have the cachet of a rock star. In fact, there's only one that I can think of, Larry Brilliant. He's a medical doctor by training. He's made the journey from being a hippie in San Francisco and training to be a monk in a Himalayan ashram to working with the World Health Organization in India to help eradicate smallpox in the 1970s, and more recently, running the philanthropic arm of Google. Along with Bill Gates, who we heard from last week, he's been trying to warn us about an inevitable pandemic for years. It turns out the way to do this is with a TED Talk, TED being a venue for cosmocrats like Bill and Larry and me to give inspiring speeches. My TED Talks are about jazz or randomised trials, but Bill Gates and Larry Brilliant's are about pandemics. And in a 2006 talk, Larry predicted that one day the world would stop.
Let me show you a simulation of what a pandemic looks like so we know what we're talking about. Let's assume, for example, that the first case occurs in South Asia. It initially goes quite slowly. You get two or three discrete locations. Then there'll be secondary outbreaks. And the disease will spread from country to country so fast that you won't know what hit you. Within 3 weeks, it will be everywhere in the world.
That was 14 years ago. So has anything at all about the past few months surprised you?
Well, first of all, no credit to Cassandra, because the entire epidemiological community for the past 20 or 30 years has been worried about a pandemic like this since so many viruses jump from animals to humans. Every year, we see spillover of animal viruses, zoonotic diseases, that jump from a chimpanzee or a duck or a bird or a cow or a pig or a bat, from the animal that is the normal host of that virus to human beings. This spillover occurs 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times every year. So that didn't surprise us. They either kill 90% of people, which means they can't spread very far, or they don't transmit very easily, in which case they can't spread very far. So this is an unusually bad virus for a pandemic. The peculiar insidious combination of transmissibility and lethality COVID has is certainly on the more dangerous end of the spectrum. Clearly, the thing which is the most surprising is neither the virus nor its effect on society as a starting point. It's the absolute incompetence of governments in the West. The Dickinsonian It's a Tale of Two Cities might yet be written. It's a tale of two kinds of countries. Our friends in East Asia, all the way from Vietnam to Taiwan to South Korea to Singapore, look at both the UK and the United States with a great deal of compassion, sadness, but even pity that we've blundered so badly, that our governments have been so incompetent, that we've added to the toll of human misery by the lack of science, with the singular and wonderful exception of our ability to make vaccines. So I think that's the most astounding thing. Neither in that TED Talk nor in making the movie Contagion did we anticipate an incompetent government response.
Larry Brilliant was one of the consultants on the film we couldn't tear ourselves away from at the start of the pandemic, Contagion. It was a prescient depiction of what was about to hit us.
The average person touches their face 3 to 5 times every waking minute. In between, we're touching doorknobs, water fountains, and each other.
Beth. Mom? No, go up to your room, honey.
So we have a virus with no treatment protocol and no vaccine at this time.
The movie featured some very glamorous scientists putting their lives on the line for the greater good. And in the real world, scientists have also stepped into the role of superheroes, creating vaccines for a novel disease in record time. It's been more than a century since the misnamed Spanish flu forced the world to grapple with an epidemic on this scale. I was hoping that COVID-19 would be this generation's once-in-a-lifetime event, but Larry Brilliant isn't so sure.
This pandemic is clearly a function of modernity. It's the third coronavirus to spill over in the past couple of decades, with MERS and SARS. There is this moment, Tim, in history where there's a mismatch between the infectious diseases of modernity, global in scope, and our political system seems to favor nationalism and provincialism, because a pandemic cannot be dealt with, as we're seeing today, at the national level. Even if you succeed on the wave 1 or 2 or 3, you will get reinfected from other countries. So this is something that, if ever there was a reason for global cooperation, a pandemic must be close to the top of that list. But there's something else about modernity that benefits the viruses of pandemics. And that is the increasing population of human beings are pushing into territory previously lived in only by animals, cutting down rainforest, cutting down forest, clear cutting to grow soy to feed pigs, and then bringing humans and chimpanzees and bats into each other's territory. The ways in which food is cultivated, particularly in the Far East, where pigs and cows and chickens and ducks all live in the same house almost as a human being. That coupled with the speed of transportation, so that every time a new virus leaps from an animal to a human, that disease can be in London or New York in 16 hours. We don't appreciate yet how perilous that combination is, or else we would be investing more money in it. We would be supporting organizations, building more scientific communities. We have to take it more seriously. We were really late off the ball on this one.
Let me take you back to the lessons that we should be learning from the eradication of smallpox. I know you were closely involved with that effort, the final years of that effort. Tell me about your first encounter with smallpox.
Oh, I was a young hippie, and I had just joined WHO at the very lowest rung in India. It was going to be a global search of the whole country to find cases of smallpox. I mean, I'd had my MD, but I had no experience, and I was the mascot on the team. And one of the epidemiologists from the Soviet Union who was to arrive and join the other 50 that were out in the field got ill, so they suggested that perhaps I could go and become a field epidemiologist. And Bill Fagey, this wonderful man who had created the strategy to eradicate smallpox, he offered to take me to see my first case of smallpox. And while I'm sure the subject was raised in medical school, it was just given a passing nod. And I was taken to this little village in Meerut district, just outside of Delhi. And Bill said, let's find the cases of smallpox. We know they must be here in children, but we couldn't find any children with smallpox. And Bill said to me, you speak Hindi, tell the village head man, the tallest man in the world is here. Bill was 6'7" or 6'8". And I said that. And suddenly all the children came out of their hiding in villages, and there were dozens of children with smallpox. And one little girl came up to us, and she was covered with smallpox. And I thought, you know, she would not live. I'd never seen anything so horrible. Every part of her body, her eyes, her nose, were covered with smallpox. I almost cried, and I said to Bill, can we call an ambulance? What do we do? And he said, there's no cure for smallpox. There's no treatment for smallpox. The only thing we can do is to eradicate this disease. And indeed, in the 20th century, the first 75 years of the 20th century, smallpox claimed between 300 million and half a billion victims. Now we've eradicated it.
So how did you eradicate it? What did the team do?
Well, interesting, in this moment when we're celebrating the UK's first ever vaccinations against COVID and the US following now, everyone is thinking about mass vaccination to get to herd immunity, looking at vaccinating 6.5 billion people. What we found in smallpox is mass vaccination doesn't work. Trying to vaccinate everyone always falls short. Some people are always traveling, new births occur, you miss a few people, there is vaccine resistance, and you fall short of a hypothetical number for mass vaccination. So Bill had been a medical missionary in Nigeria, and he had a small amount of vaccine in his hospital and a very large outbreak of smallpox. And he tried to ask himself, what is the most ethical use of this scarce vaccine? And he decided that it wasn't to vaccinate the first person to come to them, the richest people, but to vaccinate only those who were immediately susceptible to the disease, which meant those who were in the same family or next door to a case of smallpox. And so he began searching to find every case and then vaccinating in a circle around that case. That was a breakthrough strategy. In retrospect, it seems like it's intuitive, but it wasn't, because then as now, the first idea was mass vaccinate everybody. Bill went against the grain, published some papers on that, and his strategy, which subsequently became called ring vaccination, and it was used successfully also in Ebola, most recently in the Congo, that strategy is what allowed us to eradicate smallpox in really only single-digit years after having had the vaccine for 200 years. And I think if we get lucky, Tim, and one of these 150 vaccine candidates have some of the same properties as the Ebola vaccine and the smallpox vaccine, we call that property PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis. If these vaccines, or any of them, allow you to vaccinate someone after they've been exposed and stop that person from shedding the virus and spreading it, stop that person from getting the disease, then I think we will be doing that again, using vaccination as part of outbreak control, in addition to, of course, vaccinating the most vulnerable and the first responders and people in nursing homes and with pre-existing conditions. But that's what will allow us to throw COVID into the dustbin of history.
Do you think we could reasonably hope to eradicate SARS-CoV-2?
I do. Now, I have to put an asterisk on that, and that asterisk is because we know now that mink and cats, non-human primates, civet cats, have gotten COVID. And so, yes, it seems like that is a huge deterrent to the idea of eradicating the disease. But I'm still optimistic that if we can, through a combination of non-pharmaceutical interventions, masks and social distancing, lowering the curve, following it up by outbreak control, testing, tracing, and isolation, then testing, tracing, and targeted vaccination, we will get to zero in many countries. We did get to zero. Vietnam did get to zero for 2/3 of a year. And when we get to zero in multiple countries, then we'll be able to see what, if any, is the deleterious effect of an animal reservoir in some of these animals. Will that form a constant open sore from which new outbreaks will come back to humans? Or will it go out, or will we be able to find a way to stop the disease in animals as well? So if you allow me the asterisk of the animal reservoir, yes, I'm optimistic that we can bring COVID to zero cases in countries and in most countries.
I was quite struck by the fact that in describing the eradication of smallpox, you were talking about going out, finding the cases, vaccinating in a ring around those cases. In your TED Prize talk, you emphasise early detection, early warning. I was thinking, well, surely this guy's going to talk about vaccines. Vaccines are, you know, how we got rid of smallpox. And I thought, well, yeah, you, as you mentioned yourself, We had a smallpox vaccine for 2 centuries, did not eradicate smallpox. So are we, this program is called How to Vaccinate the World, are we too focused on vaccines and not focused enough on all of the other things that are going to complement a vaccine to make it effective?
I think the position that we're in is the presence of the vaccine is a necessary but not sufficient condition for controlling a disease and getting rid of a disease and on the steps to eradication, as we've talked about. Yes, we had a vaccine against smallpox for 200 years before we eradicated smallpox. We also had a vaccine against polio for more than 70 years before we came, as we are now, to the of eradicating polio. The presence of the vaccine allows you to dream about eradicating a disease. It takes more than just the vaccine. It is the necessary condition to have the vaccine. But in order to dream about eradication, you have to have a strategy that's more than just, let's vaccinate everybody, or we've succeeded the moment we have the vaccine. That's just the beginning, not the end of the quest. It's not over until it's over. If you want to eradicate a disease, you have to get rid of every single virus in the world. And to do that, you need a strategy that's much more than just mass vaccination.
While we're on this sort of slightly philosophical turn of the conversation, I heard something, Larry. Apparently, when we used to meditate each morning in India, apparently your guru threw apples at your testicles. This is the story that I've heard. Can you confirm this? And if it's true, why?
Well, that's a big leap. And it has the additional value of being true. When I was living in the monastery of my teacher, Neem Karoli Baba, which was, you know, in the foothills of the Himalayas, we would all meditate all the time. And he used to tease me and say that my destiny lie on a different path. And in order to remind me, he would throw apples at me, and he had a very good aim, as you've mentioned, in order to wake me up. And he would say, out of the blue one day, he said, you have to leave the ashram, you have to leave the monastery, and you have to go into the world, and I want you to go work for the World Health Organization and help eradicate smallpox. He said, smallpox will be eradicated. This is God's gift to humanity, but it's because of the hard work that people and health workers will do that God will lift this one form of suffering from humanity. So that was my instruction, was that meditation and prayer and devotion are really critically important for spiritual life, but also it's finding some way to give back in a very practical way to help alleviate suffering.
So if we're going to respond to this pandemic, who needs apples thrown at their sensitive spots right now?
Oh my God, there's a long list. There's a long list. The political systems of modernity need to be re-examined. Why do we have countries? Why do we have national governments? What's the purpose of government and the value of democracy? And what do we learn from being around people who are so different from us that it expands our idea of the human experience and makes us feel more sympathetic? The true measure of a civilization is how those in power treat those who don't look like them. And that's another lesson for our time.
I want to ask now about technology and how technology can help. Obviously, there's been a remarkable progress in vaccine technology. We've got these new mRNA techniques used by Pfizer and by Moderna. Do you see that as being a breakthrough that will allow other vaccines to be developed or indeed other medical treatments altogether?
I do. If you look at the Russian vaccine and the Chinese vaccine, they follow the old way of making vaccines. Nothing against that, by the way. But they use the actual virus and they attenuate it. They heat kill it. So you wind up with the shell of the virus and they then inject that. Or they piggyback it onto another virus, like an adenovirus, a common virus. And they use that as a viral transport mechanism. That's the way vaccines have been made in the past. We've had some great successes by doing that. We've also had some difficulties with diseases we've never been able to make vaccines against, like HIV/AIDS, and vaccines that we've only had partial success against, like influenza. But what the mRNA vaccines do is they use the body's transport mechanism, the RNA messenger that carries instructions to the body on how to make proteins. And they implant within it a little bit of what can only be thought of as computer code. It's so remarkable. It isn't computer code. No one should think about these are robots or anything like that. But we were able to program that mRNA so it comes to the body not as a foreign invader. It doesn't look to the body like a virus. So you don't get the kind of reactions that you get. You don't get the kind of catastrophes that we've had in the past where a heat kill vaccine wasn't properly killed, and so giving the vaccine could create an epidemic. No, with mRNA vaccines, you're giving the body the instruction kit into how to create the antigen and the antibody. You're teaching the body how to ward off the virus. That's opening up an entirely new way of dealing with vaccines, maybe with therapeutics. And so there's tremendous excitement throughout the scientific world on the success of these two mRNA vaccines. We can't have it that they have to be kept at minus 100 degrees. That's got to be fixed. We can't have it that you need two doses of it and maybe even an annual booster. It's really early days, but it's exciting days.
We have a segment in this program which is called What the Editor Doesn't Understand, where the big boss of the program asks our guests a question which has been plaguing him. And this week he wanted me to ask you, does the fact that we have separately made several vaccines, all of which seem to work, in less than a year, does that suggest that we've just been too slow in developing vaccines in the past?
Yes.
answer is exactly the kind of answer that Richard likes. He's going to be very happy with that. That's I love it.
If I can expand just a second on that, the answer is definitely yes. A pandemic creates so much fear, bewilderment. People are willing to do things in pandemic time that they're not willing to do in ordinary time. And you can read Defoe's Journal of the Plague Years. You can read Love in the Time of Cholera. Read all these books about what happened during 1918. It's a different atmosphere. And this pandemic gave Bill Gates the idea that if we funded the creation of factories that could make every conceivable kind of vaccine and funded those factories before we knew which vaccine would actually work, that we could then do in parallel what we've historically only done in sequence. The reason why it takes so long to do a new vaccine is because we did things sequentially that for this pandemic, these vaccine producers did in parallel. And therefore, your editor is right. We've unleashed a new way of doing things. It takes more money up front, more creativity up front, but look at the wonderful result. It isn't just that the vaccines took 10 months to create. It's that less than a year after a novel virus emerged and had its first contact with humanity, we have a global vaccination campaign. That's astounding.
Now, this program is going to be broadcast in the first week of the new year. So what are your predictions for 2021?
You know, in 2021, we will reach a point of near normalcy at the end of the year, but we'll have to go through the gates of hell first. The rest of January, February, March, we're going to see some of the worst parts of this epidemic in countries that don't and haven't yet learned the lessons of wearing masks, practicing social distancing, personal hygiene, finding every outbreak, testing, tracing, and isolation slash vaccination. understanding that the only way to a good economy is through ending and succeeding and conquering this pandemic. Those countries that give up, that cave in to the seduction of the idea of herd immunity via letting everybody get the disease, it's going to be a very rough time. And gradually, as more and more people are vaccinated, more and more resources are put in, more and more places are cleared out, we'll arrive with a kind of Swiss cheese approach. I really like that idea. Every single thing we're doing, whether it's mask wearing or social distancing or vaccinating or testing or therapy, every one of these is imperfect, like a single slice of Swiss cheese. But if we have a dozen of these methodologies and we lay one of those pieces of Swiss cheese over the other, all the holes are covered. And that's what it's going to take to get us to normalcy or something like normalcy by the end of 2021. So I think 2021 is going to begin in a really difficult moment. And it's going to end better if we follow this Swiss cheese model and we stay at it. And everybody's tired, exhausted. And we're asking people who've lost their livelihood, who've lost friends, who've suffered incalculable emotional losses and personal losses to stick with it for another year. It remains to be seen where and how we'll be able to do that. We might get lucky and the virus which jumps next year or next month doesn't have the characteristics of COVID, high transmissibility, high morbidity, high mortality, but we may get unlucky. Unfortunately, that's a feature of modernity.
Sobering thoughts for a new year from epidemiologist Larry Brilliant. But having lived through the trials of 2020, 2021 offers some hope in the form of vaccines. And we'll be talking more about how many are on the horizon and how they'll reach us in the next episode of How to Vaccinate the World. Our email address is vaccine@bbc.co.uk. Please send us your questions. I hope you can join me again next week. Until then, from me, Tim Harford, goodbye.
How to Vaccinate the World was presented by Tim Harford. The producer was Sandra Canthal, the editor was Richard Vauden, and it was mixed by James Beard.
Hello, this is Jane Garvey, and with my broadcasting friend, Fee Glover. Come in, Fee.
Oh, thank you, darling. Thank you. How are you?
Yeah, all right. We do a podcast together called Fortunately. It has been surprisingly successful. And you'd be really quite choked with emotion to discover that other people have found us. Some of them have quite enjoyed it. Other people like carping. We welcome all comers. We don't care who you are, where you are, what you do or what you think, as long as you're prepared to join with us in, well, what do? Fee? We kind of unravel, we unburden, we unload. What do?
We're a self-help group of two that other people quite like to witness, and we don't really mind if you laugh with us or at us. You're just welcome aboard a slightly rickety midlife ship, which occasionally has guests who are far more successful than us, but we try not to let that get in the way.
We'd love you to join in, and as Fee says, be a part of it.
All you have to do if you want to subscribe is pop along to BBC Sounds and search for Fortunately. It could not be more simple than that.